The Nobel people finally get it, a prize today for financial regulation. In politics, at least the internet is not unlimited, we learn. And our series, I've Always Wondered. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, the 13th of October. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. The phrase of the day today in global economic circles is this: market power and regulation. That's from the announcement by the Swedish Academy of Sciences this morning that Frenchman Jean Tirole had won this year's Nobel Prize in Economics. The Academy said that Tirole had won in part because of his work on, and this is a quote, taming powerful firms, the aforementioned market power and regulation. Tirole's work shows that the approach often taken by regulators is just too simple sometimes, that markets are complicated, and so controls on companies ought to be similarly complex. Marketplace's David Weinberg has the story.
There are lots of ways that financial regulators can fail at their job. One is not having the proper tools. Much of Jean Tirole's research addresses this. Here's an analogy to explain. Think of regulators as teachers in a classroom.
You're confronted as a teacher with all kinds of students. And if you simply try to do the same thing in the same way with everyone, you'll fail for most of your students, or at least a big chunk.
Bill Black is a professor of economics and a former bank regulator. In the same way a really good teacher knows how to tailor a lesson to the individual needs of students, Tirole says regulation needs to be fine-tuned to individual companies.
That is one of his essential messages, that one size doesn't fit all.
But regulators in the financial sector tend to apply a standard across the board. And the financial crisis showed us that doesn't work. Philip Swagel was Henry Paulson's chief economist during the financial crisis. He says one of the keys to effective regulation is understanding what motivates each company.
Firms have incentives, and regulators should use firms' incentives in a way that improves the stability of the financial system.
Just like students in a classroom, incentives aren't universal. Susie may be motivated by positive encouragement, but Jane might respond better to the threat of detention. Tirole's work suggests that incentives are subjective, but the right ones can work.
The idea that when times are good, that's when regulators should be the most worried and should make the most effort to make sure that firms are prepared for when asset prices go in the other direction.
Should being the key word. Everyone I spoke to agreed that regulation needs to be more specific. No one wanted to say how or when Tirole's principles might be adopted. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
Marketplace's David Gura spoke to the world's newest Nobel laureate today. We've got the interview on our website, and it will be on the Marketplace Morning Report in the morning. On Wall Street today, it looked for a while like traders were going to break their losing streak, and then they didn't. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I learned something interesting today. The internet, it turns out, is not infinitely expandable. Yes, there will always be room for more pictures of kittens, and thank goodness for that. But political advertising has its limits. Specifically, there is not enough room for all the online ads that political campaigns want to buy. Ashley Parker wrote the story in the New York Times today from which I learned all of this. Ashley, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
All right, hang on a second. How can advertising space on the internet be finite? I thought that was kind of the beauty of the internet, right?
Yeah, exactly. I sort of, too, thought the internet was limitless.
Right.
But, you know, when it comes to political campaigns, and especially in some of these very competitive states that maybe have a Senate race and a governor's race, you know, there's a finite amount of inventory on, say, premium video sites like on YouTube or on Hulu. And then if you think of other ways that people buy ads on the internet, like a homepage takeover, you know, only one group, for instance, can take over a homepage at one time. So you do sort of start seeing restrictions on inventory that most people, I don't think, are necessarily aware of.
And there are also, just about the video ads, there are two different kinds, right? There are the kind you can skip, and then there are kind you got to stick around and sit through. And they cost different things, and they're priced differently and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. So the skippable ads, and to be clear, the skippable ads, which, you know, they start playing and then it normally says you can skip this ad after 5, 4, or 3 seconds.
yes, those, I know them well.
And most people skip them. But those ads do not sell out, but they are sold via an auction system. And so just like with TV advertising, or just basically like the market supply and demand, closer to election day, more people are demanding them, the price goes up. So something that could cost, you know, 5 cents per impression in August or September could be 10 times that, you know, the week before election day. So that's skippable ads. The other types of ads are typically called reserved buy ads, and they can't be skipped. And those are the normally 15 seconds or 30 seconds of pre-roll mm-hmm. that plays before you can watch the music video you actually came to the site for. Mm. And those are more expensive often, but they can be reserved in advance, which is a big advantage for campaigns that think ahead.
Is this a sign, do you think, of the increasing maturity and sophistication of online advertising? I mean, it kind of has to be, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And you especially see these digital firms that are sophisticated thinking ahead, because now in the digital space, it's increasingly requiring the same amount of sort of planning and strategy that yeah. we previously saw for TV. So the smart campaigns are hiring smart digital strategists who are talking to Facebook and YouTube in the summer to make sure they're set for October.
Do they actually work? Do we have any data on this yet? You know, do they convince people to vote one way or the other?
Well, one thing that the campaigns actually really like about them and that the digital people will stress is you actually get a lot more data and metrics back on them than you do on TV ads. And then you can see that, you know, 80% of the people who viewed the ad to completion then went to your website, and then you can track them on your website and see how much time they spent on the website. So in that sense, I mean, I guess they don't necessarily know how much it's impacting someone and changing their opinion or their vote, but there's certainly more behavioral metrics right. you get back right. from these digital ads.
Yeah, they've got those indicators. I almost can't believe I'm asking you this, but how long do you think until fall of 2016 is sold out?
I know, right? The yeah. question is if we're going to see our first digital or TV ad right on November 5th or something.
Yeah.
But I do think that campaigns are increasingly using digital for get out the vote and for mobilization, because on digital, you can send someone to a website where they can register mm-hmm. to vote. And as get out the vote and mobilization becomes such a huge part of 2016, I think we're going to see a very crowded marketplace there.
Ashley Parker is a political reporter for The New York Times. Ashley, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Without trying to be alarmist at all, there is a small but not insignificant chance the euro may be facing some trouble. It's not the Greeks or the Spaniards posing a threat this time. Germany's newest political party, Alternative for Deutschland, it's called, wants to pull out of the single currency, and that party is getting some traction. From the European Desk Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
It's a party that some say could reignite the European debt crisis, and yet the AfD insists it's staunchly pro-European.
Brüssel, wir kommen!
At an election rally at the Brandenburg Gate in Berlin this summer, a band played the European anthem, and the new party declared its resolve to break into the European Parliament in Brussels. It has, and it's won seats in three regional assemblies in Germany as well.
So I think we are becoming a real force in German politics.
Party worker Friedrich Hilser says the AfD can now start to tackle the EU's biggest problem, the euro, in a spirit of European unity.
We have created the euro together in Europe, and so I think we should dismantle it together. That can be done in an orderly and in a planned way.
That will provoke a hollow laugh among financial traders. The mere suggestion that the world's second biggest currency could unravel would roil markets everywhere. But how much of a threat to the euro does the AfD really pose? Pavel Swiedlicki is with the Open Europe think tank.
The rise of the AfD is unusual because it seems to break the German consensus.
A consensus that held sway across all political parties.
That European integration is the best way forward.
That Germany must tie itself ever closer to its European neighbours and share a currency with them. The protest fueling support for the AfD doesn't mean Germany is about to ditch the euro, but it could trigger another wave of market unrest. The German government may now be less willing to bail out weaker member states like Greece or Italy, Moritz Kramer of the Standard & Poor's credit rating agency in Frankfurt.
So it could dig in its heels much more to try to appeal to those voters it had lost to this new party AfD on the right. And that, of course, would make the coordination of Eurozone-wide policies even harder than it is anyway.
And it could undermine the European Central Bank, making it less likely the bank will be able to stave off deflation in the Eurozone and raise investor confidence with full-blown measures like money printing.
It could indeed weaken the positive impact that is intended on the sentiment of financial investors.
Could this reignite the Eurozone debt crisis?
Well, the crisis was never fully resolved and is still festering under the surface.
Berliners have just celebrated German Unity Day with a small carnival in front of the Brandenburg Gate. In the bright sunshine, it was the last chance to soak up the late summer warmth. But winter's coming, and the storm clouds could soon be gathering over the Euro too. At the European Desk, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up in Death as in Life, location, 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 people.
I couldn't emphasize enough to you how people desperately want to be buried here.
Our series, I've Always Wondered, but first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials tumbled 223 points today, 1.3%, closed at 16,321. Selling into the close is the word you're looking for. The NASDAQ off 62 points, 1.5%, ended things at 4,213. The S&P 500 slumped 31 points, 1.6%, 1874. Energy stocks ran out of gas in a big bad way. Halliburton spilled more than 7%. Schlumberger dropped 2.3%. Merck uncapped 4% today. Johnson & Johnson slipped 2% ahead of its earnings release tomorrow. Netflix slid nearly 3% on news it's begun to charge more for its data-hungry ultra-definition, ultra-high-definition offerings, rather. Tesla skidded more than 5%. Bonds rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note, all the way down to 2.28%. You're listening to Marketplace.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. The International Energy Agency releases its monthly oil market report on supply and demand around the globe. Ralph Lauren celebrates a birthday. The designer will be 75. And if you're trying to fit into designer clothing, you should cover your ears now. Tomorrow is National Dessert Day. I wonder, what is the best way to observe this occasion? I'm Michelle Philippi.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. There was news today from the Obama administration on climate change. It wasn't the energy secretary making a statement or the head of the EPA announcing a new rule. It was Chuck Hagel, the guy who runs the Pentagon. At a meeting of defense secretaries of the Americas, Chuck Hagel talked about the implications of a coming race for resources in a warming world. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong has that story.
Climate change is what Hagel today called a threat multiplier. That is, it takes already dicey places and tacks on factors like resource insecurity. Take water. Robert Glennon at the University of Arizona says in very general terms, the drier parts of the world will likely get more so. For instance,
the Near East, Middle East, North Africa, or even Sub-Saharan Africa, China, India, Pakistan, all of those areas are fraught with tension, and changes in the availability of water will certainly heighten those tensions.
Less water means fewer crops can grow. During the war in Afghanistan, record drought limited many farmers to one plant, poppy for opium. Christian Parenti is author of the book Tropic of Chaos.
Why would farmers in southern Afghanistan support the Taliban? Well, that's the armed force that's going to defend your family's right to grow the only crop that under these drought conditions will make any money.
Going forward, the Pentagon and others see new risk with Arctic oil drilling. Ironically, fossil fuel extraction contributes to the problem in the first place. Sherry Goodman of research group CNA says melting ice provides new access to new drill sites, but also
the possibility of an accident or a stranding or a vessel running into a problem where lives are at risk.
The Pentagon's new climate adaptation roadmap notes scientists are, quote, converging toward consensus on climate change. Uncertainty remains, says the DOD, but, quote, it cannot be an excuse for delaying action. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
One share of JCP, the JCPenney Company Incorporated, could have been had at the close today for $7 and change, just a slight drop from where it started on a day when the beleaguered retailer named a new CEO. Marvin Ellison comes to the job from Home Depot. He'll be Penny's third CEO in less than 4 years and has quite the job to do because, seriously, what happened to JCPenney and that whole slice of retail that it lives in? Marketplace's Quina Kim has more.
Once upon a time, department stores like JCPenney were where you went for a bargain. Ira Kalb is a marketing professor at USC's business school.
I know that when I was in high school, my friends went there to buy underwear. So they went to JCPenney to buy things that were not fashionable items, but items where they could save money.
Ann Kalb says JCPenney still fills that niche and still has a loyal following of mostly older women bargain hunters. The problem, Kalb says, is that the world of bargain retailing has radically changed since Penny's heyday.
Now there's a lot of competition at that low end.
He says JCPenney needs to rebrand itself because Walmart and Target now dominate that space. Richard Church is an analyst at Discern Investment Analytics. He says finding a niche to attract new low to middle income consumers is difficult.
The obvious challenge is how do you retain a customer in a slower growth economic world?
Consumers are buying more online, and they're shifting their spending to gadgets from clothes. While he admires the new CEO, Marvin Ellison, he's skeptical about whether he can bring sexy back to Penny's.
Anybody who says that Penny needs to be sexy, I believe, is not looking at the picture correctly.
Bernie Sosnick is a retail analyst at Guilford Securities. He says Penny's went searching for sexy and it nearly destroyed the company. Now, after a rough couple of years, it's rediscovering its identity and getting its footing back again. I'm Quina Kim for Marketplace.
Back in January, the last time that JCPenney was in the news after having announced it was closing almost three dozen poorly performing stores, we talked to a woman in Butte, Montana. Her name is Alana Furco. She's the manager of the Butte Plaza Mall, and her JCPenney was on that closure list. Given the Penny news of the day, we called her up again to see what the latest is, and we got her, as you will hear by the muzak playing faintly in the background, actually in the mall. Alana, it's good to talk to you again.
You as well, Kai.
How has business been? It's been like 8 or 10 months since we talked back in January.
You know, our JCPenney closed in May.
Yep.
Then we rolled right into tourist season, which was extremely strong all throughout the state of Montana. And then, quite fortunately, back to school time, which has also been very strong. A few worries about the economy, but you know, we're hanging in there.
Do you miss the JCPenney store in that mall?
I miss them terribly. You know, it's a triple loss, that the business, the people who worked there, and the customers.
What's your sense, then, of how the economy is doing, the retail economy, which is sort of what we're talking about in the context of JCPenney today?
You know, we did have some of our businesses did pick up people shopping them a little stronger since we have lost our pennies. But personally, I think we're still flatlining.
When are you going to know that things are going to be all right? I mean, if you think we're still flatlining, what's it going to take to convince you that the economy's actually back? Because the numbers say it's back.
You know, I have to say myself personally, I have been very conservative about my shopping. But just this past week, I started shopping a little heavier. Maybe I was in a funk personally, but maybe things are starting to pick up. The Christmas merchandise out, maybe that's what flipped my switch. I'm seeing a lot of Christmas and, you know, Bath and Body Works with the smell of the cinnamon and the holiday fragrances. Maybe that's what I needed just to pop me out of this.
Well, so call me a cynic here, but holy cow, it's not even Thanksgiving. It's not even Halloween yet, let alone Thanksgiving. And you're already getting cinnamon and Bath and Body Works?
Absolutely. Yeah. And the cinnamon pine cones. And yeah, it's pretty exciting.
You're probably a big pumpkin spice latte person, too, aren't you?
Love it. Had one this morning. Yes.
The JCPenney folks who lost their jobs when the mall closed, did they get other, are they back working, or do you know what happened to them?
They are. I'm very grateful for the mercy JCPenney showed by not coming in and closing the doors. They gave us time to prepare, and they gave the people time to find jobs, in the majority of the cases, better jobs. Everybody landed well on their feet.
What about the physical store, that corner of the mall? What's in there now?
You know, it is empty right now. It is. There has been a little bit of interest. It's huge. It's 34,600 square feet. But, you know, our leasing agent is shopping it around. So I don't know what. I don't know when. But it will have a new life.
Alana Furco. She's at the Butte Plaza Mall in Butte, Montana. Elena, thanks so much for your time. We'll talk to you soon.
Take care, Kai.
Think about this for a second. You write a check or you pull out your credit card and you buy a piece of land. And you own it, not for years or decades or even for your whole life, but forever. The business of cemeteries is where we turn today for the latest installment of our series, I've Always Wondered.
If you wonder...
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer, by brainwork and blatant.
From Sarah Brinton of La Jolla, California, came the question of how cemeteries make money. Matthew and Vicky Hogue of Kalamazoo, Michigan, want to know if a cemetery can go out of business. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson plots out the answers in New York.
At Washington Cemetery in Brooklyn, a weed whacker sends a spray of grass clippings into the air as the ground crew weaves in between black and gray tombstones that are so tightly packed they almost touch. Manager Michael Samaga stumbled into a summer job here in the late 90s when plots were selling for $2,800 each. A few years later, they'd climbed to $16,000. And now?
People come in, and, I'll give you $30,000 if you give us a grave. And we're like, if you could give us $1 million, we don't have nothing to sell you, you know.
Washington Cemetery is full. It's squeezed out every single possible plot, shrinking the parking lot, tearing up roads, even offering up a small lawn in front of the office.
It's an odd business setup, you know.
Because if cemeteries were people, their working lives would be relatively short compared with their retirement. State laws require that many cemeteries put a certain amount of their proceeds into an endowment to support it once it's full, like a 401k. But while a retirement plan has to support a person for a few decades, this money is supposed to fund the cemeteries forever.
Forever is a pretty big promise.
John Llewellyn worries that it's a promise many cemeteries won't be able to keep. He's on the board of Forest Lawn Cemetery in Los Angeles and wrote a book called A Cemetery Should Be Forever.
Not all cemeteries put aside enough money. Some are not required by state law to put aside money. In other instances, the state sets certain minimums that are inadequate.
Just like people need to sock away as much as possible during their prime earning years, Llewellyn thinks cemeteries should be saving more. He says the best time to do this is 2 or 3 generations in, when the high startup costs of lands, roads, irrigation systems are behind you, and the revenue from sales really starts flowing. Woodlawn Cemetery in the Bronx is smack in the middle of its prime earning years, celebrating its 150th birthday this year. There are 300,000 people already here and space for tens of thousands more on its rolling hills. Woodlawn's executive director, David Eisen, drives me around, pitching me umpteen different burial options. On the low end, there's cremation.
There are those families that say, just cremate me and I don't care what you do with me.
For a few $100, their ashes can go in a common container.
So you're mingling with other people?
Yeah, I guess. For those that are more socially inclined, I guess.
For the less social with lots more money, Woodlawn has a private mausoleum available for a mere $4.6 million.
The area we're coming up to now is what we consider our Hillcrest Annex. So we are all the time staying ahead of the curve as far as developing new cemeteries.
On a little less than an acre of new space, they'll be able to fit 2,500 new people. Density is key. And by expanding, Woodlawn gives itself more inventory, more time in this middle, lucrative selling phase. Back in Brooklyn, Washington Cemetery looks a lot different from the Bronx. It's under a subway line in a much more urban area, but it's still popular with local residents.
I couldn't, emphasize enough to you how people desperately want to be buried here.
Michael Samada is hoping that a new section the cemetery is opening will help it emerge from its forced retirement.
With the Staten Island section that we opened, we'll be good for, anywhere from 10 to 15 years. After that, I have no idea.
It's relatively rare, but cemeteries can fail. On average, 8 cemeteries have been abandoned in New York State each year since 2001. They generally become the responsibility of the town. Samaga says if Washington runs out of money, they'll close the office, cut the maintenance staff, and maybe just keep on a grave digger until all of its reservations are filled. In New York, I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
We've got more answers to your I've always wondered question. Submit your own as well. It's at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out, which comes with the perhaps unnecessary observation that Columbus Day don't get no respect. Yes, the bond market was closed today, as was the federal government, because it is, after all, a federal holiday. But a study by the Society for Human Resources Management points out that in all, only 14% of organizations and businesses closed today. So there you go. All right, with that, we are out of here. Today, the Dow off 223 points, closed at 16,321, did the blue chips. The NASDAQ dipped 62 points, 4213. The S&P 500 off 31 points, 1874. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Tommy Andres, Daisy Palacios, and Gina Delvac. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.